Our next guest on Booked here at KD&K Community Radio is Tim Cooney. Thanks for joining me, Tim.
Hey, Gavin. Thanks a lot for dusting me off and putting me on the airwaves with you.
Tim is a writer, freelance journalist, and local historian whose latest piece is out now through the nonprofit Aspen Journalism, supporting in-depth reporting in the public interest online at aspenjournalism.org, and appeared on the cover of the Aspen Sunday News last month. It's called Deep Sea Divers Dewater Flooded Smuggler Mine. You write that this was a death-defying feat never before attempted in the history of diving or mining. Take us back to the scene near Aspen, 1910, Tim.
Well, let's see. 1910, of course, Aspen was always looking to come back into a new mining era. The greatest part of the mining era was between 1890 and 1893, when the U.S. government was purchasing silver every month to make silver coinage, which was an issue with the populace and the Free Silver Rights political party. And then 1893, there was a great panic. 1893, the stock market collapsed, and governments in Europe, who had some U.S. debt, wanted payments in gold, and so it drained our gold treasury. And politicians thought that it was time to stop buying silver and subsidizing silver. So the price of silver collapsed, and the Aspen mining era more or less came to a screeching halt, except for the mines, the number of mines in town that few, who were able to make money by mining lower-grade ore and shipping it out. And David Hyman was certainly one of those. He persisted. He had interest on the Aspen Mountain side and the smuggler side, as my story outlines.
And how did David Hyman fit in among other mine owners and industrialists remembered in our area? You write that he appears to be a sympathetic character among more cutthroat contemporaries.
Yeah, he was an interesting character. It surprised me when I read his autobiography, which he wrote for his family. It was never really published, and it was kind of hard to get some of these sources. But throughout, he just seemed to have a moral fiber, and he was always trying to pay off his debts and do things honestly and on the up and ups, and then he had to negotiate with the more cutthroat big-time silver barons and business people. He originally got his money to sponsor this the smuggler dewatering project from, well, at least he borrowed some from the Solomon brothers in New York, and he was acquainted with, he had all these connections. But how he compared to the others, he had, just kind of a moral fiber, and it struck me in reading the biography that, you know, this was a good guy who was trying to do well for others and be considerate, and, you know, he's a good historical example. And he had Aspen's greater good in mind, because he wanted to bring back mining to Aspen in what he called a new era of deep mining. That's why he was looking for the mystical vein, the great silver vein that still runs under town. And we just don't know, you know, mining lore, you know, how much of it still exists today. It's always a great question, tantalizing.
Well, so this was a death-defying feat never before attempted. Tell us more. Deep sea divers in Aspen.
Well, death-defying, of course. I mean, just going into those mines, the work that those miners did, you know, they had they dealt with explosions, cave-ins, and just coming and going to work, miners were killed in avalanches. And, you know, and I've got stories that I found in the old newspapers on that. And so the work itself, of course, was terribly dangerous. And then you bring in these deep sea divers with this Victorian technology who came out here and said it has never been done before. But these two guys, Fred Johnson and George Peterson, worked for a mining and salvaging company in New York City, and they were the best in the business, with 20 years experience. And so they said, yeah, we can do that. So they came out here, and three-day trip by train brought all their equipment set up, and went to work even the day after they arrived and went in there to investigate. So they had to go down a 1,200-foot free silver shaft, it was called, 1,200 vertical, and then the bottom there was 300 feet of water. And the divers, Fred Johnson, who did all the diving, found that the water pressure combined with the altitude was almost too much. And he had a heck of a time. He could only work for 20 minutes. But you have to bear in mind that this was complete pitch black darkness in a 6x10 shaft. And he had an air hose and a rope signal hose that he would yank. He had the full language of yanking on a rope to communicate with Peterson at the top, you know, what his problems were, what was going on.
When his top man was an experienced diver too, so they could communicate simply by rope tugs, because there's no other way to speak to each other, of course.
Not in those days. And then remember, there's no light either. You couldn't have an electric light underground at that time. Electricity was fairly new. They had well, in 1910, it wasn't so much. We had electricity in Aspen in 1885. And they put electricity in the mines about 1888. So they had light on their staging platform, but once he got in the water, he was in complete blackness, and he did everything with his hands and fingers. And of course, that water was cold, and he just figured everything out. He went and took apart a pump that he'd never seen before in the dark, pulled the parts out, figured it out, and went up the top and said, I need this, I need that, and went down in multiple dives. So it was death-defying just down the surface, no pun intended there, but to go down a hole like that wearing 200 pounds of heavy equipment and withstand all the pressures and have a cool head and be able to pull this off. Plus, he was a master mechanic, so that helped.
Well, yeah, and you mentioned the effect of the altitude, that it's already deep sea diving, but then you add in, you know, the equivalent of an extra couple dozen feet of water to deal with. And then why was the Smuggler Mountain mine flooded in the deeper sections?
Oh, well, there's the natural water table. You know, you have the Roaring Fork River running through, but the deep sections where they were working on both sides, you got to remember that the Aspen mineral belt was a shaped like an hourglass. The two fat ends, one on Smuggler and the other on Aspen Mountain, and the thin part went under town there, running down Original Street more or less, and under City Market, where there are these big stopes that still exist.
What's a stope?
A stope is a hollowed out room where they take the ore. They follow the vein, and then when they find it, they just, you know, scallop it out. So you have these stopes that are still under City Market. Who knows? Prices could drop at any time, don't you know? But anyway, the how this all fits together is what interested me when I put the story together. This is how the silver vein basically runs from Lenado, porpoises from Lenado through Aspen and then over to Crested Butte, and where it surfaced here, they chased it.
We want to encourage people to read the article. Again, speaking with Tim Cooney, whose piece is available online at aspenjournalism.org and also through the Aspen Daily News, came out on the cover a few weeks ago. You mentioned how the diver and engineer solves these problems in the dark with his hands, including with equipment he'd never seen and couldn't see. Then they had to do these return visits and had to take the train back to New York just to speak in the most timely, efficient manner with the funder of all this, David Hyman, the owner of the mine. Came back out, I believe, on a third visit and went back up and down. And what finally happened?
Well, the second visit, they had pretty well detailed in the story. They had to go back down. The pump, basically the repaired pump, failed. They came back out, and you're right there that David Hyman met them at the train in New York. You know, they could send telegraphs, but they couldn't catch him, you know, anyway, while they're riding the train back east. They thought everything was fine. They'd fixed the pump, and it was running for a while, but then something went wrong. Well, what went wrong was, and it busted on Christmas Eve, and then Hyman went and met him at the train and said, hey, you guys got to turn around and come back, you know. I'll basically, I'm sure he said, I'll pay you anything, which he paid plenty for. But basically what went wrong was there was a filter in the chamber or in the tunnel, the horizontal tunnel there, that busted, and the pump that they'd repaired sucked up all this debris and rocks and parts, and it kind of clogged things up and seized it up. So they came back out, and no fault of their own, they did a good repair job the first time. And so they came back out, took it apart, and fixed it, and then they had to go. It shut down a couple more times, then they finally got it right, and then they left in middle of February of 1911.
So celebrated in the local press, part of how you're able to track this history is from reading the old newspapers. Are those microfiche? I mean, are you pulling those up at the library?
Well, they're digitalized. Fortunately, Colorado's newspapers, all their newspapers are digitalized up until early 60s. So you can go on a digitalized newspaper site and do searches. And then it's fascinating because I found my relatives in Creed and Denver and stuff. It was wonderful. You put in a search, and all these stories come up. One thing leads to another. You know, you're looking for one thing, and then you see something else, and you go down these rabbit holes. Next thing you know, it's hours later. So it's a great research tool for Colorado history.
Yeah, and finally, Hyman, the owner of Smugger Mine, gives up, and, you know, the question remains, is that elusive high-grade silver still down there, and will we ever know?
Well, that's what makes mining lore so intriguing and so interesting. You know, that these stories get passed on, and, you know, what could still be there? I'd say, yes, it's still down there. And as I pointed out in the story, Chris Preusch, who is one of the miners and former owner of Smuggler Mine, he said that Anaconda and the government came in here in the early 1940s as part of the World War II effort looking for lead and uranium. And they did drilled 5,000-foot exploratory drill holes down there, took samples. Basically, they concluded that there is 850,000 tons of, quote, silver in reserve, unquote, down there still. But that's quite deep, 5,000 feet. Yet bear in mind that the deepest they were here on the smuggler side was around 1,800, 2,000 feet deep. So modern technology could come in here and get that silver. What will the twist of fate here? And skiing dries up. They may even name all the new mines after the ski runs.
Oh, man, such a pleasure talking to you. Tim Cooney is a writer, journalist, and historian. His latest piece, Deep Sea Divers, Dewater Flooded Smuggler Mine, is online at aspenjournalism.org and the Aspen Daily News. Thanks so much for speaking to Katie and Kay, and let's stay in touch. It's really fun learning more about the history of the area through your work, and hope we can continue to feature you on Katie and Kay.
Well, thank you, Gavin, and if you want to do a deep dive on Aspen journalism, thanks to Brent Gardner-Smith, my editor, you'll find a whole series of stories on different history aspects of Aspen and the Roaring Fork Valley.
That's aspenjournalism.org. Thanks again, Tim Cooney on KD&K.
All right, Gavin.